gathered to watch movies on DVD in the library, and she almost always joined in. She loved going on the Friday lunch outings, even if the staff had to put her in a triple layer of Depends and clean her up when she returned. She always ordered a margarita, rocks, no salt, despite its being technically forbidden for a diabetic. "They live like they would live in their neighborhood," Carson said of her tenants. "They still get to make poor choices for themselves if they choose." Achieving this required more toughness than I'd realized. Carson often found herself battling the medical system. A single emergency room visit could unravel all the work she and her team had done. It was bad enough that, in the hospital, her tenants could be subject to basic medication errors, left lying on gurneys for hours, which caused their skin to break down and form open bed sores from the pressure of the thin mattresses, and assigned doctors who never called Sanborn Place for information or planning. The residents were often also shipped off to rehabilitation centers where they and their families would be told that they would never go back to apartment living again. Carson gradually worked out relationships with individual ambulance services and hospitals, which understood that Sanborn Place expected to be consulted about care for its residents and could always take them back home safely. Even the primary care doctors the residents saw needed education. Carson recounted a conversation she'd had that day with the physician of a 93-year-old woman with Alzheimer's disease. "She's not safe," the doctor told her. "She needs to be in a nursing home." "Why?" Carson replied. "We have bed pads. We have alarms. We have GPS tracking." The woman was well cared for. She had friends and familiar surroundings. Carson wanted him just to order some physical therapy. "She doesn't need that. She's not going to remember how to do that," he said. "Yes, she is," she insisted. "She needs to be in the nursing home." "You need to retire," I wanted to tell him, Carson recounted. Instead, she said to the patient, "Let's just change your doctor, because he's too old to learn." She told the woman's family, "If I'm going to waste my energy, it's not going to be on him." I asked Carson to explain her philosophy for enabling her residents to continue to live their own lives, whatever their condition. She said her philosophy was, "We'll figure this out. We will maneuver around all the obstacles there are to be maneuvered around." She spoke like a general plotting a siege. "I push probably every envelope and beyond. The obstacles are large and small, and she was still sorting out how best to negotiate many of them. She hadn't anticipated, for example, that residents themselves might object to her efforts to help other residents stay in their homes, but some do. She said they would tell her, "So-and-so doesn't belong here anymore. She could play bingo last year. Now she doesn't even know where she is going." Arguing with them didn't work, so Carson was now trying a new tack. I say, "Okay, let's go find a place for her to live, but you're going with me because you could be this way next year." So far, that has seemed enough to settle the matter. Another example. A lot of the residents had pets, and despite the increasing difficulties they had with managing them, they wanted to keep them. So she organized her staff to empty cats' litter boxes. But the staff balked at dogs, as they required more attention than cats. Recently, though, Carson had worked out ways that her team could help with little dogs, and they'd begun allowing residents to keep them. Big dogs were still an unsolved problem. "You have to be able to take care of your dog," she said. "If your dog is running the roost, it may not be such a good idea." Making lives meaningful in old age is new. It therefore requires more imagination and invention than making them merely safe does. The routine solutions haven't yet become well-defined, so Carson and others like her are figuring them out, one person at a time. Outside the first-floor library, Ruth Beckett was chatting with a group of friends. She was a tiny 90-year-old woman, more twig than trunk, who had been widowed years ago. She had stayed on in her house alone until a bad fall put her into a hospital and then a nursing home. "My problem is I'm tippy," she said, "and there's no such thing as a tippy doctor." I asked her how she'd ended up in Sanborn Place. That was when she told me about her son, Wayne. Wayne was a twin born without enough oxygen. He developed cerebral palsy, he had trouble with spasticity when he walked, and was mentally delayed as well. In adulthood, he could handle basic aspects of his life, but he needed some degree of structure and supervision. When he was in his 30s, Sanborn Place opened as a place offering just that, and he was its first resident. Over the 3 decades since, she visited him almost every day for most of the day. But when her fall put her in a nursing home, she was no longer permitted to visit him, and he wasn't cognitively developed enough to seek to visit her. They were all but completely separated. There seemed no way around the situation. Despairing, she thought their time together was over. Carson, however, had a flash of brilliance and worked out how to take them both in. They now had apartments almost next to each other. Just a few yards away from where I was talking with Ruth, Wayne sat in a wing chair sipping a soda and watching people come and go, his walker set to his side. They were together as a family again, because someone had finally understood that little mattered more to Ruth than that, not even her life. It didn't surprise me to learn that Peter Sanborn Place had 200 applicants on its wait list. Jackie Carson hoped to build more capacity to accommodate them. She was, once again, trying to maneuver around all the obstacles, the lack of funding, the government bureaucracies. "It will take a while," she told me. "So in the meantime, she's created mobile teams that can go out to help people where they live. She still wants to make it possible for everyone to live out their days wherever they can call home." There are people in the world who change imaginations. You can find them in the most unexpected places. And right now, in the seemingly sleepy and mundane precincts of housing for the elderly, they are cropping up all over. In eastern Massachusetts alone, I came across almost more than I could visit. I spent a couple mornings with the founders and members of Beacon Hill Villages, a kind of community cooperative in several neighborhoods of Boston dedicated to organizing affordable services, everything from plumbing repair to laundry, in order to help the elderly stay in their homes. I talked to people running assisted living homes who, against every obstacle, had stuck with the fundamental ideas Karen Wilson had planted. I've never encountered people more determined, more imaginative, and more inspiring. It depresses me to imagine how differently Alice Hobson's last years would have been if she'd been able to meet one of them. If she'd had a Newbridge, an Eden Alternative, a Peter Sanborn Place, or somewhere like them to turn to. With any of them, Alice would have had the chance to continue to be who she was despite her creeping infirmities, to really live, as she would have put it. The places I saw looked as different from one another as creatures in a zoo. They shared no particular shape or body parts. But the people who led them were all committed to a singular aim. They all believed that you didn't need to sacrifice your autonomy just because you need help in your life. And I realized in meeting these people that they shared a very particular philosophical idea of what kind of autonomy mattered most in life. There are different concepts of autonomy. One is autonomy as free action, living completely independently, free of coercion and limitation. This kind of freedom is a common battle cry, but it is, as Bill Thomas came to realize on his homestead in upstate New York, a fantasy. He and his wife Jude had 2 children born with severe disabilities requiring lifelong care, and someday illness, old age, or some other mishap will leave him in need of assistance too. Our lives are inherently dependent on others and subject to forces and circumstances well beyond our control. Having more freedom seems better than having less, but to what end? The amount of freedom you have in your life is not the measure of the worth of your life. Just as safety is an empty and even self-defeating goal to live for, so ultimately is autonomy. The late, great philosopher Ronald Dworkin recognized that there is a second, more compelling sense of autonomy. Whatever the limits and travails we face, we want to retain the autonomy, the freedom, to be the authors of our lives. This is the very marrow of being human. As Dworkin wrote in his remarkable 1986 essay on the subject, "The value of autonomy lies in the scheme of responsibility it creates. Autonomy makes each of us responsible for shaping his own life according to some coherent and distinctive sense of character, conviction, and interest. It allows us to lead our own lives rather than be led along them, so that each of us can be, to the extent such a scheme of rights can make this possible, what he has made himself. All we ask is to be allowed to remain the writers of our own story. That story is ever-changing. Over the course of our lives, we may encounter unimaginable difficulties. Our concerns and desires may shift, but whatever happens, we want to retain the freedom to shape our lives in ways consistent with our character and loyalties. This is why the betrayals of body and mind that threaten to erase our character and memory remain among our most awful tortures. The battle of being mortal is the battle to maintain the integrity of one's life, to avoid becoming so diminished or dissipated or subjugated that who you are becomes disconnected from who you were or who you want to be. Sickness and old age make the struggle hard enough. The professionals and institutions we turn to should not make it worse. But we have at last entered an era in which an increasing number of them believe their job is not to confine people's choices in the name of safety, but to expand them in the name of living a worthwhile life. Lou Sanders was on his way to joining the infantilized and catatonic denizens belted into the wheelchairs of a North Andover nursing home when a cousin told Shelley about a new place that had opened in the town of Chelsea, the Leonard Florence Center for Living. She should check it out, he said. It was just a short drive away. Shelley arranged for her and Lou to visit. Lou was impressed from the first moments of the tour when the guide mentioned something Shelley barely noted. All the rooms were single. Every nursing home Lou had ever seen had shared rooms. Losing his privacy had been among the things that scared him most. Solitude was fundamental to him. He thought he'd go crazy without it. "My wife used to say I was a loner, but I'm not. I just like my time alone," he told me. So when the tour guide said that the Florence Center had single rooms, I said, "You must be kidding." The tour had only begun, and already he was sold. Then the guide took them through it. They called the place a greenhouse. He didn't know what that meant. All he knew was, it didn't look like a nursing home to me. "What did it look like?" I asked. "A home," he said. That was the doing of Bill Thomas. After launching the Eden alternative, he had grown restless. He was, by temperament, a serial entrepreneur, though without the money. He and his wife Jude set up a not-for-profit organization that has since taught the Eden principles to people from hundreds of nursing homes. They then became co-founders of the Pioneer Network, a kind of club for the growing number of people committed to the reinvention of elder care. It does not endorse any particular model. It simply advocates for changes that can transform our medically dominated culture of care for the elderly. Around 2000, Thomas got a new itch. He wanted to build a home for the elderly from the ground up instead of, as he'd done in New Berlin, from the inside out. He called what he wanted to build a greenhouse. The plan was for it to be, as he put it, a sheep in wolf's clothing. It needed to look to the government like a nursing home in order to qualify for public nursing home payments, and also to cost no more than other nursing homes. It needed to have the technologies and capabilities to help people regardless of how severely disabled or impaired they might become. Yet, it needed to feel to families, residents, and the people who worked there like a home, not an institution. With funding from the not-for-profit Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, He built the first greenhouse in Tupelo, Mississippi, in partnership with an Eden Alternative nursing home that had decided to build new units. Not long afterward, the foundation launched the National Greenhouse Replication Initiative, which supported the construction of more than 150 greenhouses in 25 states, among them the Leonard Florence Center for Living that Lou had toured. Whether it was that first home for a dozen people in a Tupelo neighborhood, or the 10 homes that were built in the Florence Center's six-story building, the principles have remained unchanged and echo those of other pioneers. All greenhouses are small and communal. None has more than 12 residents. At the Florence Center, the floors have two wings, each called a greenhouse, where about 10 people live together. The residences are designed to be warm and homey, with ordinary furniture, a living room with a hearth, family-style meals around one big table, a front door with a doorbell. And they are designed to pursue the idea that a life worth living can be created, in this case, by focusing on food, homemaking, and befriending others. It was the look of the place that attracted Lou. There was nothing dispiritingly institutional about it. But when Lou moved in, the way of life became what he valued most. He could go to bed when he wanted, and wake when he wanted. Just that was a revelation to him. There was no parade of staff marching down the halls at 7 a.m., rustling everyone through showers and getting them dressed and wheeled into place for the pill line and group mealtime. In most nursing homes, including Chase Memorial, where Thomas had gotten his start, it had been thought that there was no other way. Efficiency demanded that the nursing aid staff have the residents ready for the cook staff, who had to have the residents ready for the activity coordination staff, who kept them out of the rooms for the cleaning staff, etc. So that was the way the managers designed the schedules and responsibilities. Thomas flipped the model. He took the control away from the managers and gave it to the frontline caregivers. They were each encouraged to focus on just a few residents and to become more like generalists. They did the cooking, the cleaning, and the helping with whatever need arose, whenever it arose, except for medical tasks like giving medication, which required grabbing a nurse. As a result, they had more time and contact with each resident. Time to talk, eat, play cards, whatever. Each caregiver became, for people like Lou, what Gerasim was for Ivan Ilyich, someone closer to a companion than a clinician. It didn't take much to be a companion for Lou. One staff member gave him a big hug every time she saw him, and he confided to Shelley how much he loved the human contact. He had got so little of it otherwise. On Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, he'd go down to the coffee shop and play cribbage with his friend Dave, who still visited him. Plus, he'd taught the game to a man paralyzed by a stroke who lived in a home on another floor and sometimes came by Lou's place to play. An aide would hold his cards, or if necessary, Lou would, taking care not to peek. Other afternoons, Shelley would come by. She'd bring the dogs, which he loved. He was also happy, though, to spend most of the day on his own. After breakfast, he'd retreat to his room to watch television. See about the mess, as he put it. I like keeping up on what's going on in politics. It's like a soap opera. Every day another chapter. I asked him what channel he watched. Fox? No, MSNBC. MSNBC? Are you a liberal? I said. He grinned. Yeah, I'm a liberal. I would vote for Dracula if he said he was a Democrat. A while later, he took some exercise, walking with his aide around the floor or outside when the weather was good. This was a big deal to him. In his last months in assisted living, the staff had consigned him to a wheelchair, arguing it wasn't safe for him to walk, given his fainting spells. I hated that chair, he said. The people at the Florence Center let him get rid of it and take his chances with a walker. I'm kind of proud that I pushed the matter, he said. He'd eat lunch at noon around the big dining table with the rest of the house. In the afternoon, if he didn't have a card game or some other plan, he'd usually read. He had subscriptions to National Geographic and Newsweek, and he still had his books. He'd finished a Robert Ludlum thriller recently. He was starting in on a book about the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Sometimes he pulled up to his Dell computer and surfed YouTube videos. I asked him which ones he liked to watch. He gave me an example. I hadn't been to China in many years, not since the war. So I said, let me go back to the city of Chengdu, which happens to be one of the oldest cities in the world, going back thousands of years. I was stationed near there. So I got onto the computer and I punched in Chengdu. Pretty soon I was tripping all over the city. Did you know they have synagogues there? I said, wow. They tell you there's one over here, there's one over there. I was bouncing all over the place, he said. The day goes by so fast. It goes by incredibly fast. In the evening after dinner, he liked to lie down on his bed, put on his headphones, and listen to music from his computer. I like that quiet time at night. You'd be surprised. Everything is quiet. I put the easy listening on. He'd pull up Pandora and listen to smooth jazz or Benny Goodman or Spanish music, whatever he felt like. Then I lie back and think, he said. One time visiting Lou, I asked him, what makes life worth living to you? He paused before answering. I have moments when I would say I think it's time. Maybe one of the days when I was at a low point, he said. Enough is enough, you know? I would badger my Shelley. I would say, you know, in Africa, when you got old and you couldn't produce anymore, they used to take you out in the jungle and leave you to be eaten by wild animals. She thought I was nuts. No, I said. I'm not producing anything anymore. I'm costing the government money. I go through that every once in a while. Then I say, hey, it is what it is. Go with the flow. If they want you around, so what? We had been talking in a sitting room off the kitchen with ceiling-high windows on two sides. The summer was turning to fall. The light was white and warm. We could see the town of Chelsea below us, Boston Harbor's broad sound in the distance, the ocean blue sky all around. We'd been talking about the story of his life for almost 2 hours when it struck me that for the first time I can remember, I did not fear reaching his phase of life. Lou was 94 years old, and there was certainly nothing glamorous about it. His teeth were like toppled stones. He had aches in every joint. He'd lost a son and a wife, and he could no longer get around without a walker that had a yellow tennis ball jammed onto each of its front feet. He sometimes got confused and lost the thread of our conversation. But it was also apparent that he was able to live in a way that made him feel that he still had a place in this world. They still wanted him around. And that raised the possibility that the same could be the case for any of us. The terror of sickness and old age is not merely the terror of the losses one is forced to endure, but also the terror of the isolation. As people become aware of the finitude of their life, they do not ask for much. They do not seek more riches. They do not seek more power. They ask only to be permitted, insofar as possible, to keep shaping the story of their life in the world, to make choices and sustain connections to others according to their own priorities. In modern society, we have come to assume that debility and dependence rule out such autonomy. What I learned from Lou and from Ruth Barrett, Anne Braveman, Rita Kahn, and lots of others was that it is very much possible. I don't worry about the future, Lou said. The Japanese have the word karma. It means, if it's going to happen, there's nothing I can do to stop it. I know my time is limited. And so what? I've had a good shot at it.
6. Letting go. Before I began to think about what awaits my older patients, people very much like Lou Sanders and the others, I'd never ventured beyond my surgical office to follow them into their lives. But once I'd seen the transformation of elder care underway, I was struck by the simple insight on which it rested, and by its profound implications for medicine, including what happens in my own office. And the insight was that as people's capacities wane, whether through age or ill health, making their lives better often requires curbing our purely medical imperatives – resisting the urge to fiddle and fix and control. It was not hard to see how important this idea could be for the patients I encountered in my daily practice, people facing mortal circumstances at every phase of life. But it posed a difficult question. When should we try to fix, and when should we not? Sarah Thomas Monopoly was just 34 and pregnant with her first child when the doctors at my hospital learned that she was going to die. It started with a cough and a pain in her back. Then a chest x-ray showed that her left lung had collapsed and her chest was filled with fluid. A sample of the fluid was drawn off with a long needle and sent for testing. Instead of an infection, as everyone had expected, it was lung cancer, and it had already spread to the lining of her chest. Her pregnancy was 39 weeks along, and the obstetrician who had ordered the test broke the news to her as she sat with her husband and her parents. The obstetrician didn't get into the prognosis. She would bring in an oncologist for that. But Sarah was stunned. Her mother, who had lost her best friend to lung cancer, began crying. The doctors wanted to start treatment right away, and that meant inducing labor to get the baby out. For the moment, though, Sarah and her husband Rich sat by themselves on a quiet terrace off the labor floor. It was a warm Monday in June. She took Rich's hands, and they tried to absorb what they had heard. She had never smoked or lived with anyone who had. She exercised. She ate well. The diagnosis was bewildering. "This is going to be okay," Rich told her. "We're going to work through this. It's going to be hard, yes, but we'll figure it out. We can find the right treatment." For the moment, however, they had a baby to think about. "So Sarah and I looked at each other," Rich recalled, "and we said, 'We don't have cancer on Tuesday. It's a cancer-free day. We're having a baby. It's exciting. And we're going to enjoy our baby.'" On Tuesday at 8:55 p.m., Vivian Monopoly, 7 pounds 9 ounces, was born. She had wavy brown hair, like her mom, and she was in perfect health. The next day, Sarah underwent blood tests and body scans. Paul Marco, an oncologist, met with her and her family to discuss the findings. He explained that she had a non-small cell lung cancer that had started in her left lung. Nothing she had done had brought the disease on. More than 15% of lung cancers, more than people realize, occur in non-smokers. Hers was advanced, having metastasized to multiple lymph nodes in her chest and its lining. The cancer was inoperable. But there were chemotherapy options, notably a drug called erlotinib, which targets a gene mutation commonly found in lung cancers of female non-smokers. 85% of them respond to the drug, and as Marco said, some of these responses can be long-term. Words like respond and long-term provide a reassuring gloss on a dire reality. There is no cure for lung cancer at this stage. Even with chemotherapy, the median survival is about a year. But it seemed harsh and pointless for him to confront Sarah and Rich with that fact now. Vivian was in a bassinet by the bed. They were working hard to be optimistic. As Sarah and Rich later told the social worker who was sent to see them, they did not want to focus on survival statistics. They wanted to focus on aggressively managing this diagnosis. So Sarah started on the erlotinib, which produced an itchy, acne-like facial rash and numbing tiredness. She also underwent a needle drainage of the fluid around her lung, but the fluid kept coming back, and the painful procedure had to be repeated again and again. So a thoracic surgeon was called in to place a small permanent tube in her chest, which she could drain by turning a stopcock whenever fluid accumulated and interfered with her breathing. 3 weeks after her childbirth, she was readmitted to the hospital with severe shortness of breath from a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot in an artery to the lungs, which is dangerous but not uncommon in cancer patients. She was started on a blood thinner. Then, test results showed that her tumor cells did not have the mutation that erlotinib targets. When Marco told Sarah that the drug wasn't going to work, she had an almost violent physical reaction to the news, bolting to the bathroom in mid-discussion with a sudden bout of diarrhea. Marco recommended a different, more standard chemotherapy with two drugs called carboplatin and paclitaxel. But the paclitaxel triggered an extreme, nearly overwhelming allergic response, so he switched her to a regimen of carboplatin plus gemcitabine. Response rates, he said, were still very good for patients on this therapy. She spent the remainder of the summer at home with Vivian and her husband and her parents, who had moved in to help. She loved being a mother. Between chemotherapy cycles, she began trying to get her life back. Then, in October, a CT scan showed that the tumor deposits in her left chest and in her lymph nodes had grown substantially. The chemotherapy had failed. She was switched to a drug called pemetrexed. Studies had shown that it could produce markedly longer survival in some patients. In reality, only a small percentage of patients gained very much. On average, the drug extended survival by only 2 months, from 11 to 13 months, and that was in patients who, unlike Sarah, had responded to first-line chemotherapy. She worked hard to take the setbacks and side effects in stride. She was upbeat by nature, and she managed to maintain her optimism. Little by little, however, she grew sicker, increasingly exhausted and short of breath. In a matter of months, it was as if she'd aged decades. By November, she didn't have the wind to walk the length of the hallway from the parking garage to Marco's office. Rich had to push her in a wheelchair. A few days before Thanksgiving, she had another CT scan, which showed that the pemetrexed, her third drug regimen, wasn't working either. The lung cancer had spread from the left chest to the right, to the liver, to the lining of her abdomen, and to her spine. Time was running out. This is the moment in Sarah's story that poses our difficult question, one for everyone living in our era of modern medicine. What do we want Sarah and her doctors to do now? Or to put it another way, if you were the one who had metastatic cancer, or for that matter, any similarly advanced and incurable condition, what would you want your doctors to do? The issue has gotten attention in recent years for reasons of expense. The soaring cost of healthcare has become the greatest threat to the long-term solvency of most advanced nations, and the incurable account for a lot of it. In the United States, 25% of all Medicare spending is for the 5% of patients who are in their final year of life, and most of that money goes for care in their last couple of months that is of little apparent benefit. The United States is often thought to be unusual in this regard, but it doesn't appear to be. Data from elsewhere are more limited, but where they are available, for instance from countries like the Netherlands and Switzerland, the results are similar. Spending on a disease like cancer tends to follow a particular pattern. There are high initial costs as the cancer is treated, and then if all goes well, these costs taper off. A 2011 study, for instance, found that medical spending for a breast cancer patient in the first year of diagnosis averaged an estimated $28,000, the vast majority of it for the initial diagnostic testing, surgery, and, where necessary, radiation and chemotherapy. Costs fell after that to about $2,000 a year. For a patient whose cancer proves fatal, though, the cost curve is U-shaped, rising toward the end, to an average of $94,000 during the last year of life with a metastatic breast cancer. Our medical system is excellent at trying to stave off death with $12,000 a month chemotherapy, $4,000 a day intensive care, $7,000 an hour surgery. But ultimately, death comes, and few are good at knowing when to stop. While seeing a patient in an intensive care unit at my hospital, I stopped to talk with the critical care physician on duty, someone I'd known since college. "I'm running a warehouse for the dying," she said bleakly. Of the 10 patients in her unit, she said, only 2 were likely to leave the hospital for any length of time. More typical was an almost 80-year-old woman at the end of her life with irreversible congestive heart failure who was in the ICU for the second time in 3 weeks, drugged to oblivion and tubed in most natural orifices as well as a few artificial ones. or the 70-year-old with a cancer that had metastasized to her lungs and bone and a fungal pneumonia that arises only in the final phase of the illness. She had chosen to forgo treatment, but her oncologist pushed her to change her mind, and she was put on a ventilator and antibiotics. Another woman in her 80s, with end-stage respiratory and kidney failure, had been in the unit for 2 weeks. Her husband had died after a long illness with a feeding tube and tracheostomy, and she had mentioned that she didn't want to die that way. But her children couldn't let her go and asked to proceed with the placement of various devices: a permanent tracheostomy, a feeding tube, and a dialysis catheter. So now she just lay there, tethered to her pumps, drifting in and out of consciousness. Almost all these patients had known for some time that they had a terminal condition. Yet they, along with their families and doctors, were unprepared for the final stage. We are having more conversation now about what patients want for the end of their life, by far, than they have had in all their lives to this point, my friend said. The problem is that it's way too late. In 2008, the National Coping with Cancer Project published a study showing that terminally ill cancer patients who were put on a mechanical ventilator, given electrical defibrillation or chest compressions, or admitted near death to intensive care, had a substantially worse quality of life in their last week than those who received no such interventions. And 6 months after their death, their caregivers were 3 times as likely to suffer major depression. Spending one's final days in an ICU because of terminal illness is, for most people, a kind of failure. You lie attached to a ventilator, your every organ shutting down, your mind teetering on delirium and permanently beyond realizing that you will never leave this borrowed, fluorescent place. The end comes with no chance for you to have said goodbye or it's okay or I'm sorry or I love you. People with serious illness have priorities besides simply prolonging their lives. Surveys find that their top concerns include avoiding suffering, strengthening relationships with family and friends, being mentally aware, not being a burden on others, and achieving a sense that their life is complete. Our system of technological medical care has utterly failed to meet these needs, and the cost of this failure is measured in far more than dollars. The question, therefore, is not how can we afford this system's expense. It is how can we build a healthcare system that will actually help people achieve what's most important to them at the end of their lives. In the past, when dying was typically a more precipitous process, we did not have to think about a question like this. Though some diseases and conditions had a drawn-out natural history, tuberculosis is the classic example, without the intervention of modern medicine, with its scans to diagnose problems early and its treatments to extend life, the interval between recognizing that you had a life-threatening ailment and dying was commonly a matter of days or weeks. Consider how our presidents died before the modern era. George Washington developed a throat infection at home on December 13, 1799, that killed him by the next evening. John Quincy Adams, Millard Fillmore, and Andrew Johnson all succumbed to strokes and died within 2 days. Rutherford Hayes had a heart attack and died 3 days later. Others did have a longer course. James Monroe and Andrew Jackson died from progressive and far longer lasting and highly dreaded tubercular consumption. Ulysses Grant's oral cancer took a year to kill him. But as end-of-life researcher Joan Lynn has observed, people generally experienced life-threatening illness the way they experienced bad weather, as something that struck with little warning, and you either got through it or you didn't. Dying used to be accompanied by a prescribed set of customs. Guides to Ars Moriendi, the art of dying, were extraordinarily popular. A medieval version published in Latin in 1415 was reprinted in more than 100 editions across Europe. People believed death should be accepted stoically, without fear or self-pity or hope for anything more than the forgiveness of God. Reaffirming one's faith, repenting one's sins, and letting go of one's worldly possessions and desires were crucial and the guides provided families with prayers and questions for the dying in order to put them in the right frame of mind during their final hours. Last words came to hold a particular place of reverence. These days, swift catastrophic illness is the exception. For most people, death comes only after long medical struggle with an ultimately unstoppable condition: advanced cancer, dementia, Parkinson's disease, progressive organ failure, most commonly the heart, followed in frequency by lungs, kidneys, liver, or else just the accumulating debilities of very old age. In all such cases, death is certain, but the timing isn't. So everyone struggles with this uncertainty, with how and when to accept that the battle is lost. As for last words, they hardly seem to exist anymore. Technology can sustain our organs until we are well past the point of awareness and coherence. Besides, how do you attend to the thoughts and concerns of the dying when medicine has made it almost impossible to be sure who the dying even are? Is someone with terminal cancer, dementia, or incurable heart failure dying exactly? I was once the surgeon for a woman in her 60s who had severe chest and abdominal pain from a bowel obstruction that had ruptured her colon, caused her to have a heart attack, and put her into septic shock and kidney failure. I performed an emergency operation to remove the damaged length of colon and give her a colostomy. A cardiologist stented open her coronary arteries. We put her on dialysis, a ventilator, and intravenous feeding, and she stabilized. After a couple of weeks, though, it was clear that she was not going to get much better. The septic shock had left her with heart and respiratory failure, as well as dry gangrene of her foot, which would have to be amputated. She had a large open abdominal wound with leaking bowel contents, which would require weeks of twice-a-day dressing changes and cleansing in order to heal. She would not be able to eat. She would need a tracheostomy. Her kidneys were gone, and she would have to spend 3 days a week on a dialysis machine for the rest of her life. She was unmarried and without children, so I sat with her sisters in the ICU's family room to talk about whether we should proceed with the amputation and the tracheostomy. "Is she dying?" one of the sisters asked me. I didn't know how to answer the question. I wasn't even sure what the word dying meant anymore. In the past few decades, medical science has rendered obsolete centuries of experience, tradition, and language about our mortality and created a new difficulty for mankind: how to die. One spring Friday morning, I went on patient rounds with Sarah Creed, a nurse with the hospice service that my hospital system operated. I didn't know much about hospice. I knew that it specialized in providing comfort care for the terminally ill, sometimes in special facilities, though nowadays usually at home. I knew that in order for a patient of mine to be eligible, I had to write a note certifying that he or she had a life expectancy of less than 6 months. I also knew few patients who had chosen it, except in their very last few days, because they had to sign a form indicating that they understood their disease was terminal and that they were giving up on medical care that aimed to stop it. The picture I had of hospice was of a morphine drip. It was not of this brown-haired and blue-eyed former ICU nurse with a stethoscope knocking on Lee Cox's door on a quiet morning in Boston's Mattapan neighborhood. "Hi, Lee," Creed said when she entered the house. "Hi, Sarah," Cox said. She was 72 years old. She'd had several years of declining health due to congestive heart failure from a heart attack and pulmonary fibrosis, a progressive and irreversible lung disease. Doctors tried slowing the disease with steroids, but they didn't work. She had cycled in and out of the hospital, each time in worse shape. Ultimately, she accepted hospice care and moved in with her niece for support. She was dependent on oxygen and unable to do the most ordinary tasks. Just answering the door with her 30-foot length of oxygen tubing trailing after her had left her winded. She stood resting for a moment, her lips pursed and her chest heaving. Creed took Cox's arm gently as we walked to the kitchen to sit down, asking her how she had been doing. Then she asked a series of questions targeting issues that tend to arise in patients with terminal illness. Did Cox have pain? How was her appetite, thirst, sleeping? Any trouble with confusion, anxiety, or restlessness? Had her shortness of breath grown worse? Was there chest pain or heart palpitations? Abdominal discomfort? Trouble with constipation or urination or walking? She did have some new troubles. When she walked from the bedroom to the bathroom, she said, it now took at least 5 minutes to catch her breath, and that frightened her. She was also getting chest pain. Creed pulled a blood pressure cuff from her medical bag. Cox's blood pressure was acceptable, but her heart rate was high. Creed listened to her heart, which had a normal rhythm, and to her lungs, hearing the fine crackles of her pulmonary fibrosis, but also a new wheeze. Her ankles were swollen with fluid, and when Creed asked for her pill box, she saw that Cox was out of her heart medication. She asked to see Cox's oxygen equipment. The liquid oxygen cylinder at the foot of her neatly made bed was filled and working properly. The nebulizer equipment for her inhaler treatments, however, was broken. Given the lack of heart medication and inhaler treatments, it was no wonder that she had worsened. Creed called Cox's pharmacy. They said that her refills had been waiting all along. So Creed contacted Cox's niece to pick up the medicine when she came home from work. She also called the nebulizer supplier for same-day emergency service. She then chatted with Cox in the kitchen for a few minutes. Cox's spirits were low. Creed took her hand. Everything was going to be all right, she said. She reminded her about the good days she'd had, the previous weekend, for example, when she'd been able to go out with her portable oxygen cylinder to shop with her niece and get her hair colored. I asked Cox about her earlier life. She had made radios in a Boston factory. She and her husband had had 2 children and several grandchildren. When I asked her why she had chosen hospice care, she looked downcast. The lung doctor and heart doctor said they couldn't help me anymore, she said. Creed glared at me. My questions had made Cox sad again. She told a story of the trials of aging overlain with the trials of having an illness that she knew would someday claim her. It's good to have my niece and her husband helping to watch me every day, she said, but it's not my home. I feel like I'm in the way. Multi-generational living fell short of its nostalgic image again. Creed gave her a hug and one last reminder before we left. What do you do if you have chest pain that doesn't go away? She asked. Take a nitro, Cox said, referring to the nitroglycerin pill that she can slip under her tongue. And? Call you. Where's the number? She pointed to the 24-hour hospice call number that was taped beside her phone. Outside, I confessed that I was confused by what Creed was doing. A lot of it seemed to be about extending Cox's life. Wasn't the goal of hospice to let nature take its course? That's not the goal, Creed said. The difference between standard medical care and hospice is not the difference between treating and doing nothing, she explained. The difference was in the priorities. In ordinary medicine, the goal is to extend life. We'll sacrifice the quality of your existence now by performing surgery, providing chemotherapy, putting you in intensive care, for the chance of gaining time later. Hospice deploys nurses, doctors, chaplains, and social workers to help people with a fatal illness have the fullest possible lives right now, much as nursing home reformers deploy staff to help people with severe disabilities. In terminal illness, that means focusing on objectives like freedom from pain and discomfort, or maintaining mental awareness for as long as feasible, or getting out with family once in a while, not on whether Cox's life would be longer or shorter. Nonetheless, when she was transferred to hospice care, her doctors thought that she wouldn't live much longer than a few weeks. With the supportive hospice therapy she received, she had already lived for a year. Hospice is not an easy choice for a person to make. A hospice nurse enters people's lives at a strange moment, when they have understood that they have a fatal illness, but not necessarily acknowledged that they are dying. I'd say only about a quarter have accepted their fate when they come into hospice, Creed said. When she first encounters her patients, many feel that their doctors have simply abandoned them. 99% understand they're dying, but 100% hope they're not, she told me. They still want to beat their disease. The initial visit is always tricky, but she has found ways to smooth things over. A nurse has 5 seconds to make a patient like you and trust you. It's in the whole way you present yourself. I do not come in saying, I'm so sorry. Instead, it's, I'm the hospice nurse, and here's what I have to offer you to make your life better. And I know we don't have a lot of time to waste. That was how she started with Dave Galloway, whom we visited after leaving Lee Cox's home. He was 42 years old. He and his wife Sharon were both Boston firefighters. They had a 3-year-old daughter. He had pancreatic cancer, which had spread. His upper abdomen was now solid with tumor. During the past few months, the pain had often become unbearable, and he was admitted to the hospital several times for pain crises. At his most recent admission about a week earlier, it was found that the tumor had perforated his intestine. There wasn't even a temporary fix for this problem. The medical team started him on intravenous nutrition and offered him a choice between going to the intensive care unit and going home with hospice. He chose to go home. I wish we'd gotten involved sooner, Creed told me. When she and the hospice's supervising doctor, Joanne Novak, evaluated Galloway upon his arrival at home, he appeared to have only a few days left. His eyes were hollow. His breathing was labored. Fluid swelled his entire lower body to the point that his skin blistered and wept. He was almost delirious with abdominal pain. They got to work. They set up a pain pump with a button that let him dispense higher doses of narcotic than he had been allowed. They arranged for an electric hospital bed so that he could sleep with his back raised. They also taught Sharon how to keep Dave clean, protect his skin from breakdown, and handle the crises to come. Creed told me that part of her job is to take the measure of a patient's family, and Sharon struck her as unusually capable. She was determined to take care of her husband to the end, and perhaps because she was a firefighter, she had the resilience and the competence to do so. She did not want to hire a private duty nurse. She handled everything, from the IV lines and the bed linens to orchestrating family members to lend a hand when she needed help. Creed arranged for a specialized comfort pack to be delivered by FedEx and stored in a mini refrigerator by Dave's bed. It contained a dose of morphine for breakthrough pain or shortness of breath, Ativan for anxiety attacks, Compazine for nausea, Haldol for delirium, Tylenol for fever, and Atropine for drying up the wet upper airway rattle that people can get in their final hours. If any such problem developed, Sharon was instructed to call the 24-hour hospice nurse on duty who would provide instructions about which rescue medications to use and, if necessary, come out to help. Dave and Sharon were finally able to sleep through the night at home. Creed, or another nurse, came to see him every day, sometimes twice a day. 3 times that week, Sharon used the emergency hospice line to help her deal with Dave's pain crises or hallucinations. After a few days, they were even able to go out to a favorite restaurant. He wasn't hungry, but they enjoyed just being there and the memories it stirred. The hardest part so far, Sharon said, was deciding to forgo the 2-liter intravenous feedings that Dave had been receiving each day. Although they were his only source of calories, the hospice staff encouraged discontinuing them because his body did not seem to be absorbing the nutrition. The infusion of sugars, proteins, and fats made the painful swelling of his skin and his shortness of breath worse. And for what? The mantra was, live for now. Sharon had balked for fear that she'd be starving him. The night before our visit, however, she and Dave decided to try going without the infusion. By morning, the swelling was markedly reduced. He could move more and with less discomfort. He also began to eat a few morsels of food just for the taste of it, and that made Sharon feel better about the decision. When we arrived, Dave was making his way back to bed after a shower, his arm around his wife's shoulders and his slippered feet taking one shuffling step at a time. "There's nothing he likes better than a long, hot shower," Sharon said. "He'd live in the shower if he could." Dave sat on the edge of his bed in fresh pajamas, catching his breath, and Creed spoke to him as his daughter Ashley ran in and out of the room in her beaded pigtails, depositing stuffed animals in her dad's lap. "How's your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? Creed asked.
"A 6, he said.
"Did you hit the pump?" He didn't answer for a moment.
"I'm reluctant," he admitted.
"Why?" Creed asked.
"It feels like defeat," he said.
"Defeat?"
"I don't want to become a drug addict," he explained. "I don't want to need this."
Creed got down on her knees in front of him. "Dave, I don't know anyone who can manage this kind of pain without the medication," she said. "It's not defeat. You've got a beautiful wife and daughter, and you're not going to be able to enjoy them with the pain."
"You're right about that," he said, looking at Ashley as she gave him a little horse. And he pressed the button.
Dave Galloway died 1 week later, at home, at peace, and surrounded by family. A week after that, Lee Cox died too. But as if to show just how resistant to formula human lives are, Cox had never reconciled herself to the incurability of her illnesses. So when her family found her in cardiac arrest one morning, they followed her wishes and called 911 instead of the hospice service. The emergency medical technicians and firefighters and police rushed in. They pulled off her clothes and pumped her chest, put a tube in her airway and forced oxygen into her lungs, and tried to see if they could shock her heart back. But such efforts rarely succeed with terminal patients, and they did not succeed with her. Hospice has tried to offer a new ideal for how we die. Although not everyone has embraced its rituals, those who have are helping to negotiate an ars moriendi for our age. But doing so represents a struggle, not only against suffering, but also against the seemingly unstoppable momentum of medical treatment. Just before Thanksgiving, Sarah Monopoli, her husband Rich, and her mother, Dawn Thomas, met with Dr. Marcot to discuss the options she had left. By this point, Sarah had undergone 3 rounds of chemotherapy with limited, if any, effect. Perhaps Marcot could have discussed what she most wanted as death neared and how best to achieve those wishes. But the signal he got from Sarah and her family was that they wished to talk only about the next treatment options. They did not want to talk about dying. Later, after her death, I spoke to Sarah's husband and her parents. Sarah knew that her disease was incurable, they pointed out. The week after she was given the diagnosis and delivered her baby, she spelled out her wishes for Vivian's upbringing after she was gone. On several occasions, she told her family that she did not want to die in the hospital. She wanted to spend her final moments peacefully at home. But the prospect that those moments might be coming soon, that there might be no way to slow the disease, was not something she or I wanted to discuss, her mother said. Her father, Gary, and her twin sister, Emily, still held out hope for a cure. The doctors simply weren't looking hard enough, they felt.
"I just couldn't believe there wasn't something," Gary said.
For Rich, the experience of Sarah's illness had been disorienting.
"We had a baby. We were young. And this was so shocking and so odd. We never discussed stopping treatment."
Marcot took the measure of the room. With almost 2 decades of experience treating lung cancer, he had been through many of these conversations. He has a calm, reassuring air, and a native Minnesotan's tendency to avoid confrontation or over-intimacy. He tries to be scientific about decisions. "I know that the vast majority of my patients are going to die of their disease," he told me. "The data show that, after failure of second-line chemotherapy, lung cancer patients rarely get any added survival time from further treatments and often suffer significant side effects.
but he too has his hopes. He told them that at some point, supportive care was an option for them to think about. But, he went on, there were also experimental therapies. He told them about several that were under trial. The most promising was a Pfizer drug that targeted one of the mutations found in her cancer's cells. Sarah and her family instantly pinned their hopes on it. The drug was so new that it didn't even have a name, just a number, PF-023-1006, and this made it all the more enticing. There were a few hovering issues, including the fact that the scientists didn't yet know the safe dose. The drug was only in a phase one trial, that is, a trial designed to determine the toxicity of a range of doses, not whether the drug worked. Furthermore, a test of the drug against her cancer cells in a petri dish showed no effect. But Marco thought that these were not decisive obstacles, just negatives. The critical problem was that the rules of the trial excluded Sarah because of the pulmonary embolism she had developed that summer. To enroll, she would need to wait 2 months in order to get far enough past the episode. In the meantime, he suggested trying another conventional chemotherapy called vinorelbine. Sarah began the treatment the Monday after Thanksgiving. It's worth pausing to consider what had just happened. Step by step, Sarah ended up on a fourth round of chemotherapy, one with a minuscule likelihood of altering the course of her disease and a great likelihood of causing debilitating side effects. An opportunity to prepare for the inevitable was foregone, and it all happened because of an assuredly normal circumstance, a patient and family unready to confront the reality of her disease. I asked Marco what he hopes to accomplish for terminal lung cancer patients when they first come to see him. "I'm thinking, can I get them a pretty good year or two out of this?" he said. "Those are my expectations. For me, the long tail for a patient like her is 3 to 4 years. But this is not what people want to hear. They're thinking 10 to 20 years. You hear that time and time again, and I'd be the same way if I were in their shoes." You'd think doctors would be well-equipped to navigate the shoals here, but at least two things get in the way. First, our own views may be unrealistic. A study led by the sociologist Nicholas Christakis asked the doctors of almost 500 terminally ill patients to estimate how long they thought their patient would survive, and then followed the patients. 63% of doctors overestimated their patient's survival time. Just 17% underestimated it. The average estimate was 530% too high. And the better the doctors knew their patients, the more likely they were to err. Second, we often avoid voicing even these sentiments. Studies find that although doctors usually tell patients when a cancer is not curable, most are reluctant to give a specific prognosis, even when pressed. More than 40% of oncologists admit to offering treatments that they believe are unlikely to work. In an era in which the relationship between patient and doctor is increasingly miscast in retail terms, the customer is always right, doctors are especially hesitant to trample on a patient's expectations. You worry far more about being overly pessimistic than you do about being overly optimistic. And talking about dying is enormously fraught. When you have a patient like Sarah Monopoli, the last thing you want to do is grapple with the truth. I know because Marco wasn't the only one avoiding that conversation with her. I was too. Earlier that summer, a PET scan had revealed that in addition to her lung cancer, she had thyroid cancer, which had spread to the lymph nodes of her neck, and I was called in to decide whether to operate. This second unrelated cancer was, in fact, operable. But thyroid cancers take years to become lethal. Her lung cancer would almost certainly end her life long before her thyroid cancer caused any trouble. Given the extent of the surgery that would have been required and the potential complications, the best course was to do nothing. But explaining my reasoning to Sarah meant confronting the mortality of her lung cancer, something that I felt ill-prepared to do. Sitting in my clinic, Sarah did not seem discouraged by the discovery of this second cancer. She seemed determined. She'd read about the good outcomes from thyroid cancer treatment, so she was geared up, eager to discuss when to operate, and I found myself swept along by her optimism. Suppose I was wrong, I wondered, and she proved to be that miracle patient who survived metastatic lung cancer. How could I let her thyroid cancer go untreated? My solution was to avoid the subject altogether. I told Sarah that there was relatively good news about her thyroid cancer. It was slow-growing and treatable. But the priority was her lung cancer, I said. Let's not hold up the treatment for that. We could monitor the thyroid cancer for now and plan surgery in a few months. I saw her every 6 weeks and noted her physical decline from one visit to the next. Yet even in a wheelchair, Sarah would always arrive smiling, makeup on and bangs bobby-pinned out of her eyes. She'd find small things to laugh about, like the strange protuberances the tubes made under her dress. She was ready to try anything, and I found myself focusing on the news about experimental therapies for her lung cancer. After one of her chemotherapies seemed to shrink the thyroid cancer slightly, I even raised with her the possibility that an experimental therapy could work against both her cancers, which was sheer fantasy. Discussing a fantasy was easier, less emotional, less explosive, less prone to misunderstanding, than discussing what was happening before my eyes. Between the lung cancer and the chemo, Sarah became steadily sicker. She slept most of the time and could do little out of the house. Clinic notes from December describe shortness of breath, dry heaves, coughing up blood, severe fatigue. In addition to the drainage tubes in her chest, she required needle drainage procedures in her abdomen every week or two to relieve the severe pressure from the liters of fluid that the cancer was producing there. A CT scan in December showed that the lung cancer was spreading through her spine, liver, and lungs. When we met in January, she could move only slowly and uncomfortably. Her lower body had become so swollen that her skin was taut. She couldn't speak more than a sentence without pausing for breath. By the first week of February, she needed oxygen at home to breathe. Enough time had elapsed since her pulmonary embolism, however, that she could start on Pfizer's experimental drug. She just needed one more set of scans for clearance. These revealed that the cancer had spread to her brain, with at least 9 metastatic growths up to half an inch in size scattered across both hemispheres. The experimental drug was not designed to cross the blood-brain barrier. PF0231006 was not going to work. And still, Sarah